I'm going to talk today about equity and education for all, more from the perspective of what can we do about it and what is in place institutionally, what kind of international institutional architecture is in place to address this issue. It's daunting to come after two such wonderful presentations, but also to speak to an audience within which there are several who possibly know more than I do about this topic, so I'm going to be welcoming comments at the end. I teach a course on global governance and educational change, and whether I'm talking to my graduate students or talking to Canadian NGOs or to my son's grade 5 class, I always like to begin with this picture of Eleanor Roosevelt holding up the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And the reason I do this is because I want people to hearken back, to think back. What did it take for us to get a global consensus on the idea that education should be a fundamental human right? And if you know the story about the Declaration, you know that state parties were not entirely interested in producing such a declaration, and that Eleanor Roosevelt had to spend considerable time engaging what we would today call civil society actors to help pressure, particularly the U.S. government, to adopt this declaration. Of course, equity or equality was very much at the center of the formation of all the UN organizations, and perhaps nowhere more so than in the formation of UNESCO. And I just have cited a couple of places in the Constitution where this comes out. State parties believe in full and equal opportunities for education for all. The UNESCO mandate to give fresh impulse to popular education and to the spread of culture by instituting collaboration among the nations to advance the ideal of equality of educational opportunities without regard to race, sex, or any distinctions, economic or social. So that's the foundation, the formation of this global consensus happening more than half a century ago. What did we get from that normative starting point? Well, an international architecture that looks something like this. I mean, we could map it out and we could await the different power wielded or finances wielded by the international organizations, but it's basically consistent of multilateral organizations, UNESCO, the United Nations Development Program, UNICEF, the World Bank, and the OECD, not always working on the same page, not always coordinated, sometimes competing with one another for funds from national governments. Bilateral aid, Canadian CETA, USAID, often working for education for all, but with a complex set of purposes, not necessarily focused on the issue of equality. And then civil society organizations, NGOs, foundations, professional organizations, unions, business associations, and of course, more recently, transnational advocacy organizations. And I think the big thing to pull from this is that we've got a lot of actors, perhaps doing useful and productive things, but not a lot of coordination across this set of institutional actors. And we've got a lot of actors spending a fair amount of money, and that amount of money has grown very, very substantially over time, although, of course, it took a big hit in the 90s, late 90s, and has just seen increases recently. This is a very rough graph that shows total aid to education, so not just to basic education. And if I were to give you the same graph on basic education, what you would see is that the proportion being spent on basic education really didn't grow rapidly until after 2000. So we've had something that I would call a renaissance in the international community about the idea of education for all. Well, why has this happened? And well, you could tell the story in several different ways, but the way I would tell it is that there's been a bridge between a more neoliberal development model and UN, a United Nations-led focus on redistribution social protection and poverty eradication. And we can trace it back to the OECD's Shaping the 21st Century and to the World Bank IMF Poverty Reduction Strategy frameworks. It's interesting to see the World Bank and the IMF introduce education as a benchmark for their work in macroeconomic reform. And of course, to see the OECD governments at Monterey and at subsequent G8 meetings make announcements for better financing for development that all included basic education, funding for basic education. We've also got new mechanisms. in place, and I think some of these mechanisms are a great advance over earlier efforts, especially at the level of coordination. So most bilateral donors are now flirting with or fully engaged in sector-wide approaches. This means that for the first time, we find bilateral aid actually funding recurrent costs of education and actually focused on a common and integrated plan led by the government, at least in principle. And then the Fast Track Initiative, and Bob Prouty is here actually from the Fast Track Initiative, so he'll, I think, speak to that later. But the Fast Track Initiative tries to engage bilateral and multilateral and NGOs together in helping southern governments to create a common plan. The latest news is that there will be pressure from both civil society actors and from some of the bilateral donors to translate the current Fast Track Initiative into something that people are calling a global education fund, roughly modeled on some of the health funds. If we looked across this renaissance, I think we would find an ongoing tension between three different discourses. And the first is the idea of achieving equality via redistribution. Mainly the UN organizations focus on this idea, the idea that somehow we can focus on getting kids in school and that in some way will help us to redistribute life chances. And that the goal in the end is equality through redistribution. Equality via liberalization may sound for some of us who study social welfare states a little bit far-fetched, but in fact, there is a lot of argument that has been made from both the business community and from the World Bank and other organizations that if you liberalize human societies, that is, get the state out of the picture to some extent, or at least open up opportunities for individuals and communities to have greater voice, that you will achieve more equality. And this has been fundamentally at the core of the thinking of the international financial organizations about education for all. And then there's equality via voice and citizenship. One of the things that has happened since the 1990s is the notion that we want to think about equality not only in terms of material outcomes, but also in terms of voice and recognition. And I think from that angle, Education for All plays out in two ways. Indeed, we want children to have equal access and equal opportunities to learn, but the reason we want them to have that isn't only so that they can have better employment opportunities, but so that they can make claims as citizens. And that's something I think that has come out most forcefully in the work being done by civil society actors around EFA. Well, I'm going to borrow a little shamelessly from the most recent UNESCO Global Monitoring Report and tell you a little bit about where we are in terms of, I've touched the button too many times. Let's see if we can go, no, backwards. Right. The FA report says what we've got now is education for some, that there is a global divide. We know that. That's easy to see between educational life chances in the world's richest and poorest nations. And, of course, one of the areas that I think we had spent perhaps too little time attending to has been that this variation is often occurring between stable and conflict-affected states. There's a wealth gap within countries. Children from the richest households are about five times more likely to be enrolled in schooling than those from the poorest. And even in countries where net enrollment ratios have increased substantially. There's a whole range of other inequalities, gender, location, rural versus urban, ethnicity, religion, language, disability, all of which I could say fairly, have not been very well tracked or very well monitored by our international institutions. And there's a quality divide, something that has come very much to the forefront of the work of most international actors dealing with education for all. The idea that, you know, you send children to school, but in the end they come out with unable to read or to write, and this is certainly the case in many of the least developed countries in the world. There's a huge gap, as ever, between rhetoric and funding. So while the international community has made many promises, the reality is that there's quite a substantial funding gap. There have been various efforts to quantify this funding gap, and of course it depends on what your expectations are of a good basic education. But the Global Monitoring Report estimates that we have about US $3.8 billion annually, but that $11 billion is needed annually to meet the EFA goals. So there's still a very substantial gap. And the Fast Track Initiative itself has a financing gap of about $2.2 billion. What you can see here, of course, is that the total level of aid to education has actually increased from 7.3 to 11.3. Canada's contributions. I really wasn't clear in the mandate for this talk about how far I should make it focused on Canada per se, but I will stop here just for a second to say that this is an area where I think the official development aid in Canada has done a very good job. We have been among the donors to move most rapidly to fund basic education. We have been among the donors to work most systematically in sector-wide programs and in a consultative fashion with developing country governments. And we haven't hesitated to engage in programs where we are indeed paying the direct recurrent costs of things like teachers' salaries. And these are where the needs are often greatest. On the other hand, it is a travesty. I'm a Canadian, and I think I can say so. We fund ODA at a very low level, much lower than we did when I was a young person studying here in Montreal. About 0.28% of GNI goes to ODA in 2007. Though we give a high priority to basic education, in the last 10 years, the direction in which the geographic allocation of our aid has become more and more skewed to a very small number of countries, and those are countries with which or for which we have geopolitical or commercial interests. And so that actually threatens what we have been doing, the successes we have had in this area. The other thing I want to say is that it seems to me and now you've had two wonderful presentations from Canadians, but it does seem to me that so far in our international work, we have not been able to draw on the intellectual and the innovation capacity of our own domestic actors in the universities and among non-governmental organizations and in civil society. We have an international architecture that is a little bit more fit for purpose today than it was 10 years ago, but still is probably not fit for purpose. What would we need to do to get it fit for purpose? Well, first, I think, forefront, address the conflicts of purpose in aid for education. The bulk of aid is still bilateral, that is, it's delivered government to government, and bilateral aid is almost always susceptible to geopolitical and commercial interests. And it is also profoundly volatile and short-term. We have to address the failure to coordinate, and as I said, we've made strides over the last decade in this direction. But still, we need to make sure that both bilateral actors, charitable organizations, and the UN organizations are on the same page. I get very worried. One of the things that worries me, among many, I suppose, but is the fact that education is emerging as a silo. And those of us who work in education know two things very well. First of all, schools can actually produce inequality. As much as we may like to think that they can produce better equality, they also often produce inequality. But the other thing we know is that you can't provide equality through schooling alone. And so when education emerges far ahead of other sectors, like broader issues related to livelihood or child protection, that's a concern. And we have to address this question that when we have so many actors working in so many different ways, not always on the same page, not always working towards a common goal, we end up with high transaction costs, a weak ability to monitor change, and of course our ability to monitor and to address issues of inequality is very much weakened. The final thing in the aid architecture that I want to speak to, and I'll speak to it both as a scholar who studies social movements and international advocacy, and as somebody who has started a Canadian coalition, is, I think, to address problems of accountability and voice. To reform the international aid architecture requires treating one very, very fundamental problem. Citizens in the North and citizens in the South are not very well connected. Citizens in the North are not very good at holding their governments accountable, and citizens in the South are not so good at it either. And so our aid dollar, which goes government to government, is a dollar that is often not overseen by citizens themselves. And there is there are very limited opportunities for oversight and for voice. In this way, I think what we've got so far is really a flawed global compact, and one that's very much unlikely to produce a strong and sustained focus on equality. The problem with engaging or putting citizens' voice in your log frame, to use the term for results management often used in the international organizations, is that building citizen voice is very messy, and it's not likely to be efficient. Well, what kind of global compact might address the question of equality? Well, for aid, more funding, more flexible funding for conflict-affected states, coordination of aid to better target the neediest, again, avoiding the prioritization of geopolitical and strategic interests. Of course, not losing sight of country ownership of the plans. And I want to mention that coordination across charitable organizations is very key here. It's not only that the UN organizations compete or that bilateral organizations are on different plans, but that the NGOs themselves, who are contributing very substantially, also don't coordinate their activities. I want to emphasize monitoring, and I think this is where you can see the link between, say, some of the work that Doug has done and my presentation. If we look at, for example, the wonderful work that Canada has done in Tanzania in funding basic education there, one of the things we can note now is that Canada has probably reached the limit of what it wants to invest in achieving basic education in Tanzania, and the Tanzanian government is probably quite satisfied that it has opened its schools for access. The chances of those two actors being heavily invested and self-critical about the degree of inequality existing in that country is actually quite small. And I think it's here where we have a global public goods problem. We need more research on inequality itself. And we shouldn't expect the lead actors, the lead funders, to be keenly interested in showing the flaws, the inequalities in their current investments. And then, of course, new spaces for civil society and citizenship voice. There are many, many interesting experiments. We heard in the very beginning, we saw a picture of Pratham, obviously one example. There are many more. But it seems to me key that we imagine voice not only happening vis-a-vis kids and communities and their schools, but at the national level. And there's been something lost since the 1980s. In the international community, as the pressure has been put on school systems to delegitimate some collective actors, unions, for example, that played a very strong role in aggregating citizen voice. And we have to think very creatively about how to create that stronger voice at the national level. And also, I think, to link North and South. So attacking this problem of a flawed compact, I think, really does mean making sure that Canadian citizens can say to their government, we know from our citizen friends in Tanzania that things are not going as well as you say in that country, that education for all may be a reality in form, but in practice, kids are not receiving equal opportunity. I'm at zero and I'm done. Thank you.